Can money buy happiness?
Can buy me love, love, can buy me love.
Why are people happier in states where incomes are closer to equal? Did you know that middle-class drivers now spend more of their income to buy bigger cars than in 1985? These are just a few of the questions Cornell University economist Robert Frank takes on in his new book, Falling Behind: How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. This hour, we'll talk with Professor Frank and you about things like relative prosperity and why most consumer items have only fleeting effects on well-being. You can join our conversation by calling 800-642-1234, toll-free, or if you're in Madison, use 263-1890. You can also send us an email. The address, talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour, Robert Frank, is an economics professor at the Johnson Graduate School of Management at Cornell University. He is a columnist for the New York Times and the author of several books, including the one under discussion this morning, Falling Behind: How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class, published by University of California Press. And he joins us by telephone this morning. Good morning, Professor Frank.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for joining us. I want to start the show the way that you have started lectures and so forth in the past. You have some thought problems for us, and I'd like to try and engage our audience right off the bat in thinking about what you're talking about. So why don't you set us up with some sort of thought question, and we'll see how we do.
Okay. Here's one. These are like the super baby experiments. You've got to send your child to one world or another, and you know it's going to be forever, so you got to pick the right one. And the first one involves a choice of what kind of housing you'd feel more comfortable in. So there are two worlds you could go to. In one, you'll live in a neighborhood where the others have 4,000 square foot houses. All other neighborhoods on that planet have 6,000 square foot houses. In the second world, you'll live in a neighborhood where you've got a 3,000 square foot house. People in other neighborhoods have 2,000 square foot houses. So which one would you pick? There, the standard economic model seems to say it's a no-brainer. Utility satisfaction depends on absolute amounts of consumption, so you should definitely go to the world where you'd have 4,000 square feet, because that way you'd be happier, even though you'd have a relatively small house in that world. Most people don't seem to think it's a no-brainer. They hesitate. They think about which would be the better choice. And in the end, more than half of them picked the second world, the one where they'd have a 3,000-square-foot house and others would have 2,000. So it seems to suggest that people are attentive to relative house size. It's not that they want to lord a big house over their neighbors. I think most people who make that choice just have the intuition that they're going to be satisfied with their house. It's big enough. In the second world, in the first world, they probably will be longing for something more than what they've got.
Well, I don't know how you'd keep a 4,000-square-foot house clean, let alone a 6,000-square-foot house. I have enough trouble with
a
2,000-square-foot house. But it kind of demonstrates an interesting phenomenon in terms of, we think about what we want, everything's relative.
Yeah, and I think there are good reasons for that. You know, if you're in a world where you're in one of the better neighborhoods, then what follows there is that your kids will go to good schools, it'll be a safe neighborhood. It's not just a psychological thing, people feeling jealous of other people. There are very real rewards in life that go to having high relative position. So I think the fact that people are attentive to it isn't mysterious at all.
Now, in your book, you make an argument that you say can be reduced to four simple propositions. What are those?
Well, we just saw one of them. Utility or satisfaction depends on relative consumption. It's also important that it depends more on relative consumption more in some domains than in others. So to flesh out that first one, you've got to think about a second thought experiment, or it's helpful too. That's which world would you choose? You have 2 weeks of vacation, everyone else has 1 week, or another world exactly the same as the first except for one difference. you have 4 weeks of vacation. Everyone else has 6 weeks. So 2 weeks for you, 1 week for everyone else in the first world, 4 weeks for you, 6 weeks for everyone else in the second world. Here, most people choose the second world. It's not that they wouldn't notice that other people had more vacation time than they did. It's just they say, well, I don't want to take half as much vacation time just to be in a relatively advantaged position there. So that's an example of a domain where context doesn't matter quite as much as in housing. So some goods matter more, other goods matter less in terms of how context affects our evaluation of them. When that's true, the second proposition is you always get an arms race that focuses on the positional goods, the ones where context matters most, and those arms races steal resources away from the non-positional goods. That's how we fund them. It's just like a military arms race. You fund armaments purchases by having fewer hospitals and schools and other consumption goods. And the third proposition, those are harmful to public welfare. The extra expenditures on houses, as you point out, well, you just got a bigger house to clean. When everybody has a bigger house, it just shifts the bar that defines how big a house people feel they need. And then finally, the fourth proposition is that when there's a lot of growth and inequality, all those problems get worse.
Well, you particularly point out the issue for the middle class. The middle class has kind of been has almost become an endangered species in our culture over the last 3 or 4 decades, hasn't it?
It's gotten tougher because the income inequality has grown so much. I think if you think about World A versus World B, relatively big house, relatively small house, the middle class family now has a little bit more income than it had 30 years ago, maybe 15% according to the best estimates. They have a much bigger house than they did then. So in 1980, the median new house built was about 1,560 square feet. In the year 2007, the first quarter, that's the most recent data we have, the median new house was over 2,300 square feet, so more than 40% bigger in that span. They only have a little bit more income, so their budgets are really quite stretched. And the reason they're spending more on housing, I think the only coherent explanation anyone's offered is that they feel greater pressure to match the spending of others, which has gone up in the first instance because of higher spending by top earners. They're the ones who've been getting all the extra money over the last 30 years.
Well, there's an aspect of keeping up with the Joneses. That's at least part of it.
Yeah, although, John, I've resisted calling it that because that conjures up images of people who feel insecure, people who are looking for brand names on their sweaters. You know, it's really much more basic than that. You know, if you don't spend as much as other people in your part of the income distribution do on housing, the practical consequence is that your kids are going to go to below-average schools if you're the median family. There's a very tight link between how much the houses in the neighborhood cost and the perceived quality of the schools.
There was an editorial in a St. Paul, Minnesota paper that I read last Sunday, and it kind of fits in with what you're talking about because it was a fellow discussing the trends in the price of housing over the last 50 years or even in the last 75 years. And he talked about his father, who at the height of his wage earning and in a pretty decent job probably made about $12,000, which is about what they spent to buy a 3 or 4 bedroom house in the 50s. And then when he died, it was probably worth maybe twice that. But this person was talking about when the house that he bought for, say, $60,000 or $70,000 was now worth three times that. Mm-hmm. And so anybody coming in this generation or the next generation having to buy a house was having to pay quite a few times more than he paid for the same house, still same square footage. And now instead of one wage earner being able to support the mortgage payment, it requires two people to buy the same amount of house. And it's still the same 2 or 3,000 square foot house, or even 2,000 square foot house, or even 1,500 square foot house. It's still the same house, but it now takes two people to earn enough money to pay for it.
That's the expenditure arms race we've been talking about. Yeah, people don't have more money than before. But because people at the top have been building so much bigger and spending so much more, that shifts the frame of reference for people just below them. They spend more, and then they interact with people close to them just below. They spend more, too. And you get a cascade that's gone all the way down the income ladder. And so, yeah, as you point out, even if the house is the same size, it costs more now. There's a bidding war for houses in good school districts. There's goal number one for most parents. You want to be in a safe neighborhood with good schools. Schools are evaluated like other things. It depends on context. What's a good school? It's one that's better than other schools. A bad one's one that is worse than other schools. And so every time you get an extra earner in the family, every time the banks liberalize the down payment requirement, every time the interest rate falls, there's just more purchasing power available to bid for houses in the better school district, and that's the first thing parents do. And in the end, it's like the stadium metaphor. Everybody stands up to see better. Nobody sees any better than if they'd all remained comfortably seated. It's a very frustrating process for the middle.
And yet city planners sometimes sort of build this into their city plan. For example, they've got a lot of old housing stock that they'd like to replace or get rid of. And so the first thing they do is they make available more property for people to build the really high-end homes, because somebody will move up into that, and that will open up some better housing stock. And then somebody down the food chain will move into that, and they'll be able to eliminate or replace some of the older housing stock. And that's urban development. That's supposed to be a good thing because it increases the property tax base. What you're saying is that there are some negative consequences to this as well.
That's right, and we've seen lots of communities, too, ones that are located close in, convenient to urban centers where people want to be and close to where they work. Now that the income gains have been concentrating at the top, that locational advantage is really attractive to people with money to spend, and so we see people buying up houses in those neighborhoods, bringing in the wrecking ball and raising them to the ground and building much, much bigger houses on the same lots. So the scraper phenomenon, some analysts have called it.
Or industrial warehouses located along rivers suddenly becoming upscale lofts. That's something that's happened in the past. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have more conversation, and you certainly have a chance to join in, dear listener. And in fact, I would appreciate it if you would and participate in this conversation. We're talking about the new book that's just been written and published by Robert Frank, who's an economics professor at the Johnson Graduate School of Management at Cornell University. The book is called Falling Behind: How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. We're talking about how we're falling behind as a nation, and you can join our discussion. Here's how you do it. You can call 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. And in Madison, we'd prefer it if you'd call us at 263-1890, 263-1890. If you'd like to send us an email, here's the address, talk@wpr.org. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, Lord, you made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, it's no shame to be poor. But it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man, I have a dividend. All day long I bidibidibum. If I were a man, I wouldn't have to work hard.
If I were a rich man, or as my wife likes to sing, if I won the lottery. We're talking about falling behind, how rising inequality harms the middle class. That's the title of a new book by economist Robert Frank. You can join our discussion by calling us at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. Here's what's coming up a little later on the Ideas Network after 1 o'clock. On Talk of the Nation, conventional wisdom says the road to energy independence must start with a different kind of car. A look at the global race to fuel the car of the future after 1 on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network. We've got some callers who want to join our discussion, so why don't we go to the phones right now? We'll take a call first from Greg in Madison. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, John. Good morning to your guests. Professor Franks, I have a question for you.
Yes.
In the state of Wisconsin, we pay property taxes based on the relative value of our homes and a tax levy, and that money is equally distributed within the community to all the schools.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, then why are some schools better in richer neighborhoods and worse in poorer neighborhoods? There should be relatively little difference between the two.
That's a great question. In many communities in the U.S., as you know, it's not that way. It's the tax payments that are collected on local property in the community that fund the school districts in those neighborhoods, and so there's not equalization to the extent you describe where you live. What we know now, though, is that even in places where there's absolutely equal expenditure per pupil because of peer effects in the classroom, most families want to send their children to schools that are attended by the children of the upper-income families because those children seem to do better in school. They've had advantages in the home. They've had tutors. They've had lessons. The curriculum moves at a slightly faster pace in those schools, and so the data are pretty clear that if you go to a school where the parents are earning more, the achievement level in those schools is going to be higher. And so you get that even when there's complete equalization of expenditure. In France, for example, if you want to if you want to send your kids to a good school, you've got to live in the 5th or the 6th or the 16th arrondissement. You can't do it in one of the down-market ones. And even though expenditure per pupil is exactly the same across all those schools, you got to pay more if you want to get into one of the desired ones.
Let's go next to Eugene in Viola. Eugene, good morning. Thanks for calling us today.
Good morning. This little valley I live in, this little village, if you go back all 40 years here, and I've been around this village for about 50 years, you could buy a good home in the 60s here for about $12,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I just latched on, looked at the right person, the right place, the right time. I bought an old Victorian nobody wanted. I think I gave about $2,500 for the old place. So at that point, everybody wanted to rent style homes.
Right.
And land here at that time, if you go back to even 15 or 20 years, you could buy land for $500 an acre. Now you're looking at $3,000 an acre. And you've had people coming out of the cities that have been building big and beautiful homes up in here. But the average person winds up buying a trailer house.
Yeah.
Moving into the trailer courts. I just can't afford it. Just can't afford to do it.
We've seen that happen at every level. What's interesting about the change in the distribution of income is that it seems to repeat itself however you define subsets of the population. So if you look at college graduates, it's been the same there. Most of them are not earning much more than they were 30 years ago. The ones at the top are earning spectacularly more. That's true of dentists. It's true of electrical engineers. It's just a very strange process where there's been greater inequality in every group that we can measure. And so the millionaires are complaining, too. They're complaining they can't any longer afford a penthouse with a view because the billionaires have outbid them for them.
Well, one of the things that's been happening in Wisconsin is that we have a lot of lakes in this state. I forget the number, but there are quite a few. And the lakefront is very expensive, and it didn't used to be that. But what's happening now is people who've had family homes on lakefront for years and years and years are suddenly finding that they're almost being priced out of their own homes because people are coming in and paying incredibly huge amounts of money for lakefront and then tearing down whatever's on it and building some really expensive house. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden everybody's property value goes way up and they have to pay more in taxes.
That's right.
And their income hasn't gone way up. And so all of a sudden they can't even they have to sell something that may have been in their family for two generations or more.
So when you hear all these stories, it's not so puzzling. If we go back to that thought experiment we discussed at the top of the hour, it's not so puzzling that someone might think to himself, well, I'll probably have a less stressful life if I've got the 3,000 square foot house in the world where everyone else has 2,000 rather than the other way around, if I've got 4,000 in a world where everyone else has 6,000.
Sometimes it seems to me, though, that money is like closet space. No matter how much you have, you always seem to want more. You fill up the need always expands to fill whatever the capacity is and then some.
Yeah, John Maynard Keynes wrote an essay in 1930 called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, and he seemed worried in this essay that productivity was going to grow so much that we'd be able to meet all our needs in 2 hours a day of work, and then we wouldn't know what to do for the rest of the day. And I was so astonished to read that, and here was one of the smartest economists of the 20th century. How could he not have perceived that human needs were virtually boundless? I mean, there's always something else to buy. And the things we do buy, there's always someone, if they're able to pay more, will pay more, and so we'll have to pay more. So there's really no limit to the amount of money a family feels it needs. Just it keeps escalating as others spend more.
Now, at the very beginning of the program, I asked the question: can money buy happiness? Do you think we can, or is that impossible?
You know, there are two main findings in the empirical literature on happiness and how it relates to income. One of the findings suggests that the answer is no. So that is a group of studies that tracks happiness levels in countries over time as income levels rise for everyone. So if you look at a country like Japan, where you had very rapid income growth from 1960 to 1980, in that environment, the income growth was very rapid, and the happiness levels over time just stayed flat as a pancake. And that finding's been replicated in many, many other countries. So if you look only at that finding, it seems that money doesn't buy happiness. It just raises the bar that defines what people expect. Everybody gets more, everybody expects more, nobody's happier. There's a second finding. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
There's a second finding, though, that points directly at why people care so much about money, which is that if you look within a country at a given moment in time and look at the average happiness level of people across different income levels, there it's a very striking positive relationship. The people with high incomes, on average, are much, much happier than people with low incomes. There's a lot of individual variation, so everybody knows a rich person who's miserable. There are plenty of poor people who are happy, but on the average, there's a very sharp increase in happiness levels as income rises at any moment in time. So all those findings seem to underscore the importance of relative income. People ask the question, how am I doing? Can I afford the things I feel I need? And the answer is more likely to be, I'm doing okay and I can afford what I feel I need if I have high relative income.
Let's go next to Laura in Madison. Laura, good morning.
Good morning. Housing seems to be a critical issue in what we're talking about. It really bothers me that we've pushed for home ownership to such a degree that we have people who are taking out these predatory subprime loans who can't afford it. And in Madison, for example, half the people here rent, but yet affordable rental stock is not easy to find.
Right.
And we have gentrification happening in the downtown area, where what was once affordable rental housing is being converted into condos, and condos that, you know, where half of the condos haven't even been sold. It kind of boggles the mind. We keep our minimum wage depressed and, you know, pretend that people aren't trying to put roofs over their heads who make the minimum wage. And, it's just, how are we going to sustain this?
You know, it's these kinds of dislocations that you're seeing have mainly to do with the fact that the income growth has been so uneven. Virtually all the income growth for the last 30 years has been concentrated among people at the very top of the income ladder. The higher up you go, the more spectacular the growth has been in terms of rates, not just absolute amounts. And so I think as long as market forces are causing that to happen, and I don't think it's mainly malfeasance, as it has been in a few highly publicized cases, as long as it's just the market bidding for top performers in a more competitive environment that we've got now, we can't really expect people to exercise restraint. You know, you can't say to the pay boards, don't try to hire the best talent to manage your organization. So really we have to ask the question, what should we be doing as a society about this? Is it a good thing for society that incomes are growing so unequally? Most other countries have the same level of pre-tax inequality we do. I was surprised to see that Germany and Sweden have almost the same pre-tax inequality that we do. They lean very hard against the increase in inequality that's been served up by the market. They've got lots of social safety net that tries to undo some of the increase in inequality. And we've been doing just the opposite. We've been dismantling the social safety net. At the same time, we've been giving big tax cuts to the very people who've been the beneficiaries of the increased competition for top performers, namely the top earners in the economy. So I think 100 years from now, people look back and say, well, what were they thinking in doing all that?
One of the things that is interesting as I was looking at your book here, you've got some charts that show differences in before and after tax income, and some pretty interesting statistics there. But what I wanted to get at is you kind of made 1979 sort of a line of demarcation where something changed. What happened after 1979 that caused the income disparity or the wealth inequality that we see in this country and, as you mentioned, elsewhere in the world to accelerate so rapidly?
Yeah, I think there's nothing magic about the year 1979. In fact, if you really try seriously to date the change in pattern, most observers have pushed it earlier than that, but that's not really the important point. It's that for the three decades after World War II, the growth across income classes was very uniform. It was about 3%, whether you were rich, middle, or low income. That did change somewhere, either late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s, somewhere in there. We saw a change that really picked up steam greatly throughout the 80s and 90s, and it was to do with changes in technology, changes in regulation. There was a lot of deregulation that took place in the 70s, but mainly it was technology. It was possible to figure out who the best performers were. Shipping costs were going down. Cargo containers were enabling people to get stuff around the world at very low cost. We knew who had the best products. You know, it used to be if you had the best tire in northern Ohio, you were a player in the tire industry. You know, now everybody reads Consumer Reports. There's only a handful of tire makers worldwide that can compete for your business. So the process of good performers being able to extend their reach through technology is really the main thing that's been driving this. And the computer revolution, the communications revolution, the shipping revolution, all that really started sometime in the early 70s, roughly speaking.
Let's take another phone call. We'll go to Joy in West Bend. Joy, good morning.
Hi. Thanks for this important program. I do think that happiness is tied to money, and it's mostly because of advertising, you know, making people think that they want things. Anyway, I just want to imagine if we had some lawmakers that were visionary to try to bring back more equality, what kind of laws could be made that might not be called communist or socialist that could help to equalize people's incomes and thereby, you know, make people not only more equal but more happy?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the top, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. The people at the top, interestingly enough, are less happy, I think, because mm-hmm. there's so much inequality in our system. That's counterintuitive, but
right.
If you look carefully at the studies, there's actually some good evidence for that. What I propose in Falling Behind is that we scrap the income tax altogether, just throw it out, and in its place adopt a very steeply progressive consumption tax. And the way that would work is you would report your income to the tax authorities just the way you do now, so it's a similar step there. then you would report how much you saved during the year. And we know how to do that from having 401k accounts and other retirement accounts that we've implemented. So then you take those two numbers, your income and how much you saved this year, subtract your savings from your income, that's how much you spent this year. And then subtract from that a big standard deduction, let's say $30,000, and that's the amount you pay tax on. And it's a very low rate in the beginning, maybe 10%, but then the rate escalates, and beyond some point, it can escalate very sharply. So with the income tax, we don't want the top rates to get too big, because then we're taxing savings and consumption, and we've got too little savings as it is. We're going to discourage work effort and so on. If you tax consumption at a high rate, what that does is it encourages families who can to save money rather than spend it, and so that slows down the rate of growth of mansions. Those who want to build another wing on the mansion, fine. You pay a 100%, a 200% tax on the amount you spend doing that. That helps reduce the deficit and fund social safety net programs we've been cutting back. And at the same time, with a slower rate of growth of spending on mansions at the top, the people just below the top feel less pressure to spend more, and then that cascades all the way down. So it would really take a lot of the pressure off the middle-class family if we could somehow slow the luxury spending cascade at the top. And that's easy to do. People, if they spend less on building onto their mansions, it doesn't seem to cause any trouble. As John said at the top of the hour, if everybody's got a bigger house, everybody's less happy because of all the extra hassle.
Well, except for the carpenters and plumbers and electricians who build the houses.
Well, they can build warehouses for the investment spending that's financed by the extra savings. You know, it's not necessary to employ carpenters building mansions. They can build 500 square foot houses. You know, it's total spending, not consumption spending by top earners, that really governs how much output and employment is going to be. And we can make decisions about that. Where do we want the spending to occur?
First house I ever owned was less than 700 square feet, and I haven't had anything yet since that had the view that I had from that house.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have some more phone calls, and a line just opened up. So if you'd like to join us, you can call 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. 263-1890 is the number you should use if you are in Madison. That's a local number, and you can save us a buck or two by not calling that 800 number. We'll be right back with more of our discussion about the rising inequality and disparity. We're falling behind as a nation, and the middle class is kind of taking it on the chin. The title of the book under discussion, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class, published by University of California Press. And we have the author with us, Robert Frank, who's an economics professor from Cornell University. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this week. This is the Ideas Network. It's 8:45. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. And this hour we're discussing the topic of money, and specifically we're talking about a new book just published called Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And we are going to take some more phone calls about this topic. I want to remind you, though, something coming up a little later today on the Ideas Network. The U.S. Comptroller General is traveling across the country on a fiscal wake-up tour. How appropriate. After 5, Ben Marins and his guests discuss the difficult choices in budget, tax, and health care reform facing the United States in the 21st century. That's David Walker is the U.S. Comptroller General. He'll be on with Ben Marins after 5 today on the Ideas Network. Well, let's go back to the phones, and this time we'll take a call from Susan in Milwaukee. Susan, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead with your comment or question.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. First of all, Mr. Frank, thank you so much. I am delighted to have tuned in to you this morning because I think a lot about the issues that your book is about, and it helps make sense of my world. I'm going to go right to work and order your book. I'm assuming I can get it online.
Oh, what good news.
Now, I work for the Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative Corporation, which is a micro lender here in Milwaukee for minority groups. And if it's true what research has shown, that the economy is expected to grow, or 80% of the economy is expected to grow through the work of entrepreneurs rather than working for corporations or being an employee, has anyone started to study this, and what type of impact will that have on the economy?
You know, I think the American economy has always been entrepreneurial, way more so than many of the European economies, and I think that's why we've been successful in developing new products and shipping them around the world over our history. We're a little bit in danger, I think, of losing the knowledge base that's fueled a lot of that activity. So because of the budget deficits that we've had in recent years, we've been cutting back on all sorts of things that I think nobody really thinks we ought to be cutting back. Among them, the budget for the National Science Foundation. You know, we've had various sources of comparative advantage internationally over the years, but our one enduring one has been higher education and scientific research. We've just come up with the newest, most powerful ideas here at an unprecedented rate relative to other cultures, and I think a lot of that has been based on the generosity of people in funding that kind of work, and we're cutting that back now. So I think that's probably a mistake. We want to encourage new technology, not discourage it, because, as you point out, the people who seize on those new ideas and turn them into viable businesses, that's the source of a lot of new jobs in the country. And we've exported a lot of goods that way. We want to continue to do that.
Thanks for the thanks for that call. We had another caller who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to ask a question. Dennis from Madison wants to know, why is it that there's a problem building McMansions when it's the middle class that does the building and derives the income from building them?
That's a perfectly reasonable question, and I think many who've defended the tax cuts that were received by the wealthy say, well, that will stimulate jobs for people further down. You'll get a trickle-down effect. What we know is that people in the middle are not doing particularly well. Wages have not grown on an hourly basis for the last 25 years. For men, wages are actually lower on an hourly basis. So it's true that a carpenter finds work if a rich person builds a wing on a mansion, but there's lots of ways for carpenters to find work. That's not the only way. It really depends on what we spend. So if you would give a middle-class family a tax cut, then a carpenter would find work putting a kitchen addition on a smaller house. Just that's work, too. You know, we don't need to build mansions. If you think about it, you know, the rich families come out kind of with a bad deal here. You know, they've had extra money, mostly from the market, but also now from tax cuts. They're not bad people. They earned it. They're spending their extra money. That's what everyone does. So they have more elaborate birthday parties for their children, coming-of-age parties now for the wealthy. Some of them cost $10 million. You know, if you don't have 50 Cent perform at your daughter's coming-of-age party, that's somehow a disappointment in some circles. That's not money that's spent to achieve any grand purpose. You know, when everybody spends more, it just raises the threshold of what people have to spend to avoid disappointing people on special occasions. You know, the same families are driving across dilapidated bridges that collapse into the river below. It's not a good trade for them.
Okay, but I work hard, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I come up with a new widget, and I suddenly, or a new .com scheme or something, and I made all this money. I worked hard for it. Who are you to tell me that that's a bad thing, and why should you be able to tell me that I can't spend it on whatever I want, regardless of what happens to somebody else?
Yeah, I think that's the kind of conversation we've been having about tax policy. So when somebody says, why should we be giving tax cuts to the wealthy when we have other pressing needs we're not attending to? the typical response is, he thinks the bureaucrats know how to spend your money more wisely than you do. I make a lot of money, at least way more than I ever imagined I would. I feel like I would like to be taxed more heavily because I don't like it when I hear about the bridges falling into the rivers. I don't like it when I hear that they're cutting back on the Energy Department's program to round up loosely guarded nuclear materials in the former Soviet Union. It doesn't please me that we're not spending money publicly to inspect the cargo containers that come into our ports. You know, I have my own private after-tax income. I'll spend that as I see fit, but we have to have a conversation about how we want to spend the part of our national income that goes to the public purpose, you know, and there are lots of things that none of us could do if we didn't have things we spent in common. You know, we need to have that conversation, and I think it too often gets short-circuited by people say, he thinks the bureaucrats know how to spend your money more wisely than you do. The real question is, how do we want to spend our money?
Let's go next to John in Viroqua. John, good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I think this kind of my comment and question kind of dovetail on what you're just talking about. Is that I think there's this perception that really skews the reality. And I think if you go back 100 years and look at Thorsten Veblen, who was your progenitor almost exactly 100 years ago, he talked about invidious distinction and conspicuous consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the arguments that you're making that's of interest is that people are looking at relative skills, and you're saying the talent pool is for schools and for corporate people, for instance, the more talented they are, the more they get paid.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that really that's almost become like a celebrity kind of thing where you're famous because you're famous.
There is a lot of that, yes.
And we pay people more now just because we're rich, really. You know, I went to what was supposed to have been a really good school. It was a private school where all the really rich people sent their kids, but yet it was us scholarship kids that were really the star performers there. And I would argue that if you looked at the income distribution amongst all the people who went to that school, that the highest performers academically would not be the highest earners now.
Right, yeah. They needed the wealthy kids to be able to afford the scholarships to the smart poor kids, I guess you could say. If they didn't have the wealthy kids, they wouldn't have been able to pay for the poor kids to come, the ones who were smart.
Or wealthy alumni,
yeah.
Let's go next to Michael in Madison. Michael, go ahead.
Oh, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. It's an interesting conversation. I work in the area of affordable housing here in Madison, so it's always close to home. I was wondering if your guest could make some comments, please, on why it is the kind of the upper economic elite that he's talking about, these folks that say the upper 1 to 5% of earners, why it is that their incomes have seemingly exponentially multiplied in the last 30 years. I mean, I'm trying to get a sense as to whether or not the value, the social utility, and the value of their labor has increased in like proportion. Are they simply that much more economically useful, or is it the case that regulations, say in the financial and banking industry, have loosened such that they can conjure this wealth out of thin air more easily? I suppose my conspiratorial bent tends to towards the second, but I'd just be interested in hearing his educated thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's a complicated question. It's a different answer in every occupation and industry, but there have been some common threads that we can identify. So I think just to take one case study, look at the tax advice industry. That was a quintessentially local practitioner industry 40 years ago. You went to your local accountant. If you got help at all, that's where you went. And the good accountants dealt with bigger accounts than the lesser ones, and so there was some income disparity across accountants, but the differences weren't that big. Then there were two waves of change that came through. One was the tax preparation franchise wave, that the H&R Blocks. They discovered you could hire non-professionals to do 95% of the work. You could train high school graduates in form completion, and they'd sit in the back room and do that and get it 95% of the way done. If a complicated question arose, then they would consult one of the trained accountants on staff. And so they figured out a way to sort of mechanize the process, make it a lot more efficient. And what that did was it steered a lot of income away from local accountants to the people who developed those franchises. Then the next wave was tax software for the masses, you know, the big shootout between all the software programs. TurboTax was the big winner. There were a couple of others that survived. But, you know, once you figured out what the most user-friendly, comprehensive program is, you don't need the second best one. You can stamp out as many copies as you want of the best one, and it's the developer of that program who gets the huge bonanza as a result of the shootout. It's a transfer from lots of different people who were in the trenches to a few at the top.
I want to try and sneak one more call in here. Let's go next to Joe in La Crosse. Joe, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I just wanted to say that one of the things that your guest was just speaking of was the creation of money and getting more money and getting more money. But money's to the point now where it chases its own tail. And the goal of having more money is to ultimately have more money. But it hasn't always been that way. And money still has an aspect of means to an end, but we don't pay any attention to that anymore. And so the income inequities grow bigger because it just now, if you've got money now, the point isn't to do something with it. The point isn't to benefit individuals and help people develop. The point is to make more money in whatever way is best suited to that. So now we have all these financial options like LBOs and any kind.
Right.
I mean, there's hundreds of them. You could bore people to death in 5 minutes with them. But the goal now is not for money to be a means, but to be an end in and of itself, because we've removed the spiritual dimension from money.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Good thought to close on, Professor.
There is a lot of that. The irony in it is that when you look at the happiness research, the people who care most about making money are among the least happy of the people surveyed. Maybe they make more money, but if you look at two people who've made a lot of money, one made a lot of money doing something he really liked and got good at, and just by accident that happened to be rewarding financially. Another one whose only goal was to make a lot of money, they both made a lot. It's the first guy who's going to be happy by a wide margin compared to the second guy. Yeah, people really do seem to have lost sight of what the main goal is here.
Professor Frank, it's been an enjoyable hour talking to you about your new book. Good luck.
Yeah, I enjoyed our conversation. Thanks so much for having me on.
Robert Frank, an economics professor in the Johnson Graduate School of Management at Carroll University and a columnist for the New York Times, author of the book Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class, published by University of California Press. This program was produced by Karen Prager, who also handled on-air production. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can call the radio store at 747-7444 and ask for program 103C, as in cash. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.